Hello, this is Jane reading the New York Times for Thursday, May 2, 2024. From the front page, Blinken turns up pressure on Hamas to accept Gaza ceasefire deal. By Edward Wong, Adam Raskin, and Thomas Fuller. Secretary of State Antony J. Blinken delivered twin messages to Hamas and Israel on Wednesday, pressing Hamas to accept a ceasefire proposal while at the same time urging Israeli leaders to put off a major ground invasion into the thickly populated southern Gaza city of Rafah. On the last day of a Middle East trip, his seventh visit to the region since the war began in October, Mr. Blinken tried to turn up the pressure on Hamas. "We are determined to get a ceasefire that brings the hostages home and to get it now, and the only reason that that wouldn't be achieved is because of Hamas," Mr. Blinken said at the start of a meeting in Tel Aviv with Isaac Herzog, the president of Israel. "There is a proposal on the table, and as we've said, no delays, no excuses, the time is now." The proposed agreement calls for the release of 33 hostages in the initial stage of a ceasefire and would lead to the release of Palestinian prisoners being held in Israel. Mr. Blinken's comments, which were made in Tel Aviv and Jerusalem, were part of a concerted campaign by the Biden administration to secure a pause in a war that, Gazan officials say, has killed more than 34,000 Palestinians. The bloodshed has roiled American campuses and is seeping into domestic politics. Mr. Blinken also made clear that he expected more from Israel. Speaking to reporters on Wednesday night after a day of meetings with Israeli leaders, including nearly 3 hours with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, Mr. Blinken said that the Israelis had not convinced him that they can prevent the humanitarian catastrophe that is feared should there be a ground invasion of Rafah. "We cannot, will not support a major military operation in Rafah absent an effective plan to make sure that civilians are not harmed, and no, we've not seen such a plan," Mr. Blinken told reporters. "There are other ways, and in our judgment better ways, of dealing with the real, ongoing challenge of Hamas that does not involve, require, a major military operation." Mr. Blinken's visit to the Middle East, which began on Monday, came as Israel is both softening some of its demands in negotiations over a ceasefire and digging in on its vow to move into Rafah with or without a deal, as Mr. Netanyahu put it earlier this week. In its latest proposal, Israel said it would ease travel back to northern Gaza for Palestinian civilians uprooted by its assault, according to two Israeli officials. That is a sharp reversal on an issue that has been a sticking point in the talks. For weeks, Israel had demanded that it be able to impose significant restrictions on Palestinians heading to the north, out of concern that Hamas, which set off the war with its deadly October 7 attack on Israel, could take advantage of a large-scale return to re-strengthen itself. Now, Israel has consented to Palestinian civilians going back en masse during the first phase of an agreement, according to the officials, who spoke on the condition of anonymity to share details of the proposal. One of the Israeli officials said those returning to the north would be subject to no inspections or limitations, while the second said there would be nearly no restrictions, without elaborating. It was not clear whether Hamas would accept the Israeli proposal. On Wednesday night, a spokesman for the group, Osama Hamdan, said in an interview on Lebanese television, "Our position on the current negotiating paper is negative." But the Hamas press office later clarified those comments. "The negative position does not mean negotiations have stopped," the press office said. "There is a back-and-forth issue." Hamas has long demanded that any deal include a permanent end to the war, which has forced most of Gaza's more than 2 million people to flee their homes. The Israeli offer, according to one of the Israeli officials, does not include language that explicitly discusses an end to the fighting. Mr. Blinken discussed the hostage and ceasefire deal on the table in his meeting with Mr. Netanyahu in Jerusalem on Wednesday, according to a summary from the State Department. He also spoke about the U.S. government's clear position on Rafah, the summary said. With about 1 million civilians sheltering there, U.S. officials say that Israel should carry out targeted operations against Hamas leaders and fighters in the city. Mr. Blinken also spoke with the leader of the opposition in the Israeli parliament, Yair Lapid. Afterward, Mr. Lapid said in a social media post that Mr. Netanyahu had no political excuse not to make a deal to declare a ceasefire and free the hostages. "Every hour is critical," he said. Increasing the flow of humanitarian aid to civilians in Gaza has been a recurrent theme during Mr. Blinken's stops in Israel and a day earlier in Jordan. On Tuesday evening, he visited a warehouse in Jordan where trucks were being loaded with food and medical aid to go to the newly opened Erez crossing into northern Gaza. "This is real and important progress," Mr. Blinken said, "but more still needs to be done." The following day, some 30 trucks with goods from Jordan rolled through the crossing. The opening was promised weeks ago, but the Israeli military said it had needed to build inspection facilities and pave roads on both sides of the border before the crossing could be used by aid trucks. On Wednesday, Mr. Blinken also visited an inspection checkpoint at Kerem Shalom, a southern border crossing between Israel and Gaza. Flatbed trucks with bags of food aid bound for Gaza, onions, rice, and cooking oil, were awaiting inspection. Yoav Gallant, Israel's defense minister, walked around with Mr. Blinken. Before touring the checkpoint, Mr. Blinken visited an Israel kibbutz that was one of the sites attacked by Hamas and its allies on October 7. At kibbutz near Az, he entered a burned-out home where a family of five, all American citizens, had been killed. Across the border on Wednesday, Israeli airstrikes continued. The Gaza Health Ministry said Wednesday that the bodies of 33 people killed in strikes had been brought to local hospitals over the past 24 hours. Next, Arizona lawmakers repeal 1864 abortion ban, creating rift on the right. By Jack Healy and Elizabeth Diaz. Arizona lawmakers voted on Wednesday to repeal an abortion ban that first became law when Abraham Lincoln was president and a half century before women won the right to vote. A bill to repeal the law passed 16-14 in the Republican-controlled state Senate with the support of every Democratic senator and two Republicans who broke with anti-abortion conservatives who dominate their party. It now goes to Governor Katie Hobbs, a Democrat, who is expected to sign it on Thursday. The vote was the culmination of a fevered effort to repeal the law that has made abortion a central focus of Arizona's politics. "We are standing in a moment of Arizona history," said State Senator Anna Hernandez, a Democrat who called the repeal measure up to a vote on Wednesday. The issue has galvanized Democratic voters and energized a campaign to put an abortion rights ballot measure before Arizona voters in November. On the right, it created a rift between anti-abortion activists who want to keep the law in place and Republican politicians who worry about the political backlash that could be prompted by support of a near-total abortion ban with no exceptions for rape or incest. The 1864 law had gathered dust on the books for decades, but it exploded into an election year flashpoint 3 weeks ago when a 4-2 decision by the state Supreme Court, whose justices are all Republican appointed, said the ban could now be enforced because of the overturning of Roe v. Wade. After the repeal is finalized, abortions in Arizona will be governed by a 2022 law that prohibits the procedure after 15 weeks of pregnancy and makes no exception for rape or incest. But the repeal will not take effect until 90 days after the legislature adjourns for the summer, meaning that the 1864 ban could still end up temporarily derailing abortion access in Arizona if a court allows it to go into effect. Arizona's Democratic Attorney General and Planned Parenthood Arizona have gone to court to keep the law from being implemented. Two Republican state senators, T.J. Shope and Shauna Bullock, joined with Democrats on Wednesday to force the repeal bill to a vote over furious attempts by far-right Republicans to block it. Before casting her pivotal vote, Ms. Bullock stood up and began a long, deeply personal speech describing her own three challenging pregnancies, including one that ended with an abortion procedure in her first trimester because the fetus was not viable. Would Arizona's pre-Roe law have allowed me to have this medical procedure even though my life wasn't in danger? She asked. But Ms. Bullock, whose husband is one of the Arizona Supreme Court justices who upheld the 1864 law, also railed against Planned Parenthood and Democratic support for abortion rights. She suggested that her vote to repeal the 1864 ban could be the best shot for conservatives to thwart the abortion ballot measure. "We should be pushing for the maximum protection for unborn children that can be sustained," she said. "I side with saving more babies' lives." As she spoke, abortion opponents watching from the public gallery erupted with angry shouts. "Come on, this is a disgrace. One day you will face a just and holy God." The repeal was a significant loss for the anti-abortion movement, which had relied on its outsized strength in the Arizona legislature. The vote came hours after conservatives celebrated a 6-week abortion ban that went into effect in Florida on Wednesday morning. The repeal leaves Republican lawmakers divided about whether to place their own more restrictive abortion measure on the ballot in November to compete with the constitutional amendment supported by abortion rights groups. Conservative activists had worked for years to elect and support anti-abortion proponents to the legislature, enabling them to stand firm against outside pressure. But the narrow loss showed that they are vulnerable even in the places where they have built some of their greatest power, as their national political influence weakens. Several anti-abortion Republican lawmakers made fiery speeches that framed the vote in spiritual terms. They equated abortions to Nazism and compared the repeal with the September 11 attacks. They read graphic descriptions of later-term abortions. They quoted the Bible and made direct appeals to God from the Senate floor. Some saw the repeal not simply as a rejection of anti-abortion principles, but an explicit rejection of Christianity. Two choked up. Senator J.D. Mesnard, who represents a suburban swing district, held up his phone and played a sonogram recording of his daughter's heartbeat. "If I vote yes, these will be fewer, these heartbeatings," he said. State Senator Anthony Kern, a Republican who was also among Arizona's fake electors indicted last week in an election conspiracy case, said the Senate was betraying its opposition to abortion and predicted that the vote would pave the way for acceptance of pedophilia. "This is innocent blood," he said. "Why can't we show the nation we are pro-life? We will have the blessing of God over this state if we do that. Our only hope is Jesus Christ." Democrats, for their part, mostly stayed silent or made brief statements supporting repeal. After the repeal passed, State Senator Ava Birch, a Democrat, called it one step in the right direction and quickly pivoted to focus on the coming fight over the abortion ballot measure. Ms. Birch became a particularly visible face of the abortion rights movement in Arizona this year after she made an emotional floor speech to announce she needed an abortion to end a non-viable pregnancy. She criticized the two Republican defectors for their past votes on abortion issues, but said they stood with us to overturn the 1864 ban. "I'm grateful for that," she said. Legislators had tried twice to force a repeal bill to a vote in the Republican-controlled state legislature, only to be blocked by conservative lawmakers. In tense scenes inside the state capitol, Democratic lawmakers shouted "shame" at Republicans, and anti-abortion activists filled the chambers with prayers to uphold the law. Then last week, three Republican members of the House joined with every Democrat in the chamber and voted to repeal the 1864 ban, sending it to the Senate for final approval. Before the vote on Wednesday, anti-abortion activists gathered outside the Capitol in a last-ditch effort to urge lawmakers to reconsider. They prayed under a tree, read scripture over a loudspeaker, and argued with abortion rights supporters. Amira Coronado, 17, took the morning off from her high school classes, put on a light pink T-shirt, and drove to the Capitol with her mother and siblings to support the repeal effort. As she walked toward the Sunsplash Plaza, a woman yelled at her, "Abortion is murder." "I know how to speak," Ms. Coronado said, as an anti-abortion activist made a case that Arizona needed stricter abortion laws. "This law, it's from when slavery was here." In another corner of the plaza, Marisol Olivia Valenzuela faced off with a cluster of anti-abortion demonstrators from Apologia Church, a Phoenix congregation that supports so-called abortion abolition that would criminalize abortion from conception as homicide. "It's murder," Charlie Castile, 16, told Ms. Olivia Valenzuela. She was not having it. "You're standing here as a male, but you will never have to make that decision," she said. "I am totally pro-life, but why can't we meet in the middle? Government shouldn't govern our bodies. Government has nothing to do with this." After the Senate vote, Representative Nancy Gutierrez, a Democrat and the House Minority Whip, said she was excited that they finally got the bill to the governor's desk. "It will absolutely save lives," she said. "However, we are not finished. We still have an initiative to get on the November ballot that will codify abortion access in our Arizona Constitution." Ada Martin, 55, who owns her own educational consulting company and is on the board of Planned Parenthood Advocates of Arizona, heard the news of the repeal as she was celebrating her birthday. "It was a positive development," she said, but noted the three-month lag time in which the ban could be in effect. "Passing the ballot measure in November is still her primary goal," she said. "People tend to have a perception about abortion, but as far as I am concerned, abortion is health care, and the communities that are most adversely affected, regardless of religious influence, are communities of color," she said. "I am just worried about the ability for those individuals to make choices about their bodies." In economic news, Fed holds rates steady, noting lack of progress on inflation. By Gina Smialek. Federal Reserve officials left interest rates unchanged and signaled that they were wary about how stubborn inflation was proving, paving the way for a longer period of high borrowing costs. The Fed held rates steady at 5.3% on Wednesday, leaving them at a more than two-decade high, where they have been set since July. Central bankers reiterated that they needed greater confidence that inflation was coming down before reducing them. "Readings on inflation have come in above expectations," Jerome H. Powell, the Fed chair, said at a news conference after the release of the central bank's rate decision. The Fed stands at a complicated economic juncture. After months of rapid cooling, inflation has proved surprisingly sticky in early 2024. The Fed's preferred inflation index has made little progress since December, and although it is down sharply from its 7.1% high in 2022, its current 2.7% is still well above the Fed's 2% goal. That calls into question how soon and how much officials will be able to lower interest rates. "What we've said is that we need to be more confident that inflation is coming down sufficiently and sustainably before cutting rates," Mr. Powell said. "It appears that it's going to take longer for us to reach that point of confidence." The Fed raised interest rates quickly between early 2022 and the summer of 2023, hoping to slow the economy by tamping down demand, which would in turn help to wrestle inflation under control. Higher Fed rates trickle through financial markets to push up mortgage, credit card, and business loan rates, which can cool both consumption and company expansions over time. But Fed policymakers stopped raising rates last year because inflation had begun to come down, and the economy appeared to be cooling, making them confident that they had done enough. They have held rates steady for six straight meetings, and as recently as March, they had expected to make three interest rate cuts in 2024. Now, though, inflation's recent staying power has made that look less likely. Many economists have begun to push back their expectations for when rate reductions will begin, and investors now expect only one or two this year. Odds that the Fed will not cut rates at all this year have increased notably over the past month. Mr. Powell made it clear on Wednesday that officials still thought that their next policy move was likely to be a rate cut and said that a rate increase was unlikely, but he demurred when asked whether three reductions were likely in 2024. He laid out pathways in which the Fed would or would not cut rates. He said that if inflation came down or the labor market weakened, borrowing costs could come down. On the other hand, if we did have a path where inflation proves more persistent than expected and where the labor market remains strong but inflation is moving sideways and we're not gaining greater confidence, well, that could be a case in which it could be appropriate to hold off on rate cuts, Mr. Powell said. Investors responded favorably to Mr. Powell's news conference, likely because he suggested that the bar for raising rates was high and that rates could come down in multiple scenarios. Stocks rose and bond yields fell as Mr. Powell spoke. The big surprise was how reluctant Powell was to talk about rate hikes, said Michael Feroli, chief U.S. economist at J.P. Morgan. He really seemed to say that the options are cutting or not cutting. Still, a longer period of high Fed rates will be felt from Wall Street to Main Street. Key stock indexes fell in April as investors came around to the idea that borrowing costs could remain high for longer, and mortgage rates have crept back above 7%, making home buying pricier for many want-to-be owners. Fed officials are planning to keep rates high for a reason. They want to be sure to stamp out inflation fully to prevent quickly rising prices from becoming a more permanent part of America's economy. Policymakers are closely watching how inflation data shape up as they try to figure out their next steps. Economists still expect that price increases will start to slow down again in the months to come, in particular as rent increases fade from key price measures. My expectation is that we will, over the course of this year, see inflation move back down, Mr. Powell said on Wednesday, but he added that my confidence in that is lower than it was because of the data that we've seen. As the Fed tries to assess the outlook, officials are likely to also keep an eye on momentum in the broader economy. Economists generally think that when the economy is hot, when companies are hiring a lot, consumers are spending, and growth is rapid, prices tend to increase more quickly. Growth and hiring have not slowed down as much as one might have expected, given today's high interest rates. A key measure of wages climbed more rapidly than expected this week, and economists are now closely watching a jobs report scheduled for release on Friday for any hint that hiring remains robust. But so far, policymakers have generally been comfortable with the economy's resilience. That is partly because growth has been driven by improving economic supply. Employers have been hiring as the labor pool grows, for instance, in part because immigration has been rapid. Beyond that, there are hints that the economy is beginning to cool around the edges. Overall, economic growth slowed in the first quarter, though that pullback came from big shifts in business inventories and international trade, which often swing wildly from one quarter to the next. Small business confidence is low. Job openings have come down substantially. Mr. Powell said Wednesday that he thought higher borrowing costs were weighing on the economy. We believe that our policy stance is in a good place and is appropriate to the current situation. We believe it's restrictive, Mr. Powell said. As the Fed waits to make interest cuts, some economists have begun to warn that the central bank's adjustments could collide with the political calendar. Donald J. Trump, the former president and presumptive Republican nominee, has already suggested that interest rate cuts this year would be a political move meant to help President Biden's re-election bid by pumping up the economy. Some economists think that cutting in the weeks leading up to the election, either in September or November, could put the Fed in an uncomfortable position, drawing further ire and potentially making the institution look political. The Fed is independent of the White House, and its officials have repeatedly said that they will not take politics into account when setting interest rates, but will rather be guided by the data. Mr. Powell reiterated on Wednesday that the Fed did not and would not take into account political considerations in timing its rate moves. "If you go down that road, where do you stop? So we're not on that road," Mr. Powell said. "It just isn't part of our thinking." Also from the front page, United Methodist Church reverses ban on practicing gay clergy, by Ruth Graham. The United Methodist Church removed on Wednesday its long-standing ban on ordaining gay clergy, formalizing a shift in policy that had already begun in practice and that had prompted the departure of a quarter of its U.S. congregations in recent years. The overturning of the 40-year-old ban on self-avowed practicing homosexuals passed overwhelmingly and without debate in a package of measures that had already received strong support at the committee level. Delegates meeting in Charlotte, North Carolina, also voted to bar local leaders from penalizing clergy or churches for holding or declining to hold same-sex weddings. The vote effectively allows same-sex marriage in the church for the first time, although the original penalty was already unevenly enforced. Some clergy may still decline to perform same-sex weddings. Further votes affirming LGBTQ inclusion in the church are expected before the meeting adjourns on Friday. "We've always been a big-tent church where all of God's beloved were fully welcome," said Bishop Tracy Smith Malone, the new president of the denomination's Council of Bishops and the first black woman to serve in that role. She called the vote a celebration of God breaking down walls. She described the atmosphere in the room as a Pentecost moment in which the presence of the Holy Spirit was palpable. Last week, the conference approved the first phase of a regionalization plan that would restructure the global denomination to give different regions autonomy on adapting rules on issues including sexuality. The move is seen as a way to diffuse tensions between the increasingly progressive American church and more conservative factions internationally. Though the end of the ban on gay clergy applies to the global church, regionalization means that in practice it may primarily affect churches in the United States. The United Methodist Church is the second largest Protestant denomination in the nation. The Southern Baptist Convention is the biggest. There were 5.4 million Methodists in the United States in 2022, a steep decline from just a few years earlier, and a number that is expected to drop again once last year's accelerated departures are counted. Delegates also voted this week to end a ban on using United Methodist funds to promote acceptance of homosexuality, a change particularly welcomed by those in ministries working with LGBTQ people. "The energy that's gone into preparing for and trying to get to this moment can now be refocused," said Jan Lawrence, the executive director of Reconciling Ministries Network, a group that advocates for full inclusion in the church. "We have a huge opportunity in front of us." Ms. Lawrence noted that not only were all the group's goals for the meetings likely to be achieved, but they were doing so in an atmosphere that was notably agreeable, even joyful. Wednesday's vote follows years of turmoil in the denomination over sexuality, an issue that has prompted tumultuous debates and schisms in other Christian traditions and institutions. Conservatives in the Episcopal Church and the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, for example, have formed breakaway denominations in reaction to the acceptance of gay clergy. Catholic Church doctrine forbids same-sex relationships, but Pope Francis has alarmed some traditionalists by allowing priests to bless same-sex couples. At their most recent meeting in 2019, Methodists voted to tighten an existing ban on same-sex marriages and gay and lesbian clergy. Since that contentious vote, however, the denomination's makeup has changed, in large part because of conservative congregations departing in anticipation of the loosening of strictures around homosexuality that are becoming official this week. My name is Jean, and it's been my pleasure to read for you.